It is 8:54 a.m. Wednesday, October 23rd, and this is the in-person interview of Bridge Prep Academy, Inc. The board and technical review panel appreciate that you have come today, and we understand that application process requires time, effort, and intensive commitment, and we wish to thank you for your interest in providing quality education choices to the children of Arizona. The purpose of this interview is for the applicant to demonstrate how well it understands and has thought through the plan presented in the written application. The interview panel will use the responses to the questions to evaluate the capacity of the applicant to successfully implement the plan as outlined in the application. We will start with introduction of the interview panel team.
Please introduce your team and include what role each member played in
the
application.
My name is Melissa Brown. I work for the New Mexico Public Education Department. And this is my second year serving as an applicant review team.
I am Judy Thompson, and I currently work for the Paradise Valley Unified School District, which happens to be right up the street from here. My previous experience includes working for the Arizona State Board for Charter Schools and writing curriculum.
Good morning. My name is Ian Hoder. I currently work for Charter School up in Peoria. I serve as a sixth grade teacher as well as the instructional coach for grades 3-8, and mostly teaching throughout my 17 years in education with some administration here and there.
And I'm Rachel Hanna, representative of the board and board staff. I'm the assistant director of charter support and accountability.
I'll now go over the details of today's interview. This interview will last 90 minutes. The procedures and ground rules for the interview process are as follows. You will be given 5 minutes for introductions to make your opening statement. I will cue you when you have 1 minute remaining. And when the 5 minutes is complete, I'll just put a palm up, let you know if your time's up. Expect to spend 2 to 3 minutes on the initial response to each question, allowing time for any follow-up questions made by the interview panel. And feel free to ask any questions for clarification during that process. In order to give you the opportunity to respond to all of our questions, during the response to an individual question, the TRP team lead may ask you to move on and give you the opportunity to address any other responses in your closing statement. When 10 minutes remain in the interview period, you will be asked to make a closing statement of no more than 5 minutes. We will conclude the interview with a description of the next steps. Does anybody have any questions so far? Sometimes I tend to read really quickly. Okay, I'll turn things over to Melissa.
Now. Please introduce your team and include what role each member played in the application process, as well as what role each member intends to have if the charter is approved.
Alex Garcia, Facilities and Operations.
Larry Rivero, I oversee compliance, accountability, and technology. I help piece the application submission together. So I have that name. Pretty much most of the sections.
JC Quintana, I handle finance, legal, HR, and anything dealing with non-facility-based operations.
My name is Louis Nicuzzi. I am a board member, or the board chair, for the board that would oversee the school here at Buckeye.
Hi, I'm Diane Katz, and I oversee curriculum. I also oversee professional development as well as the instructional coaches.
Good morning, I'm Patty Garcia. I am lead principal for the Bridge Prep Academy schools. So I oversee the principals, I transition principals when they come in to work with us, and I support throughout the school year in all of our campuses.
Now would you please follow with your opening statement?
Sure. Good morning and thank you for having us. I'd like to give you some background so you have a full understanding of our program. Bridge Prep Academy of Buckeye, if we're so fortunate, will be a tuition-free public charter school, serving students in grades K through 8. They will engage in a challenging academic curriculum that includes a unique extended second language program in Spanish. Our goal is for all our students to master the Arizona academic standards in core subjects, as well as acquire proficiency in the Spanish language. Our model works whether the student's first language is English, Spanish, or any other language. Our model is currently used in 14 charter schools throughout the state of Florida. We're actually spread into 10 different counties within the state of Florida currently. We serve a very diverse population of 7,000 students, with 65% of them qualifying for free and reduced lunch. Several years ago, we were approached at the National Charter School Conference by several individuals familiar with our model and expressing interest in seeing our model expand into different states. Due to Arizona's growth and similarity demographically with Florida, the board decided that Buckeye would benefit from our educational model. Again, we're excited to be here and look forward to a long and successful relationship. Time.
He was under. Nice job.
All right. So I will kick things off. Can you please describe how are the board meetings going to be conducted across multiple school sites and states?
Sure. Like I explained, in Florida, we serve 14 different counties. It's very difficult to have a board meeting and everyone to be together. So we use Zoom for our meetings, sort of like FaceTime for business, right? And we also have, you know, whenever possible, face-to-face meetings, whenever we do get together face-to-face. So yeah. We would anticipate with the meetings here, with any local representation here, doing it the same.
Yeah, and Sunshine Law also in the state of Florida requires that there's quorum live. So when we do hold these meetings, they kind of, as the liaisons guiding the board, because the board are volunteers, as I'm sure you all know, so in order to ensure that they're compliant, they rotate through all different counties. And those Zoom meetings are always interactive with parents that wish to attend and so forth, if the rotation is not at their site. So the rotation throughout the fiscal year takes throughout different campuses, throughout different charters throughout the state of Florida, because we actually hold the meetings at the schools throughout the schedule. But board quorum has to be live. That's how it's always handled. But there's so many common board members, like for example here when we're done and we get approved and we start getting local representation and there's a sub-board to the school, always the board members that are not able to fly up or are not able to be here will always participate through Zoom, but there has to be quorum in person. It's how the board meetings are taking place. The attorneys put all that together. They're the ones that make sure that the boards are complying and doing everything.
So with 14 charter schools in Florida and potentially one here, that's more than one a month. Do you have more than one board meeting a month?
Well, no, the 14 charters have only four boards because the boards are per county, per area. So it's really just four boards. That are inks or if responsible. Then there's charters within that board. Like here, I'm sure every county has schools under each board. In the public school system, it's ran very similar. That's how the attorneys kind of put the infrastructure together for them.
And so Buckeye would be a fifth?
The Buckeye would be a sub-board, the local representing board to the parent board, correct. And it'll be a mix, I think, with the outcome of all our the diligence we've been doing and the networking in the community that we've done. You know, it would include the local representatives of stakeholders, plus it would also include, for the fidelity of the model and the program that's been around for 10 years, it would include a couple of the parent board members that are able to travel frequently and so on.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
so
next question follows along. So how are you going to ensure that your board meetings are going to meet Arizona Open Meeting Act and encourage parent and community involvement?
Yeah, so we've been doing this for quite some time, and we've always been in compliance. We always put that to council. Council ensures that the responsibilities of being able to comply with statutes or the Arizona standards or requirements for public board meetings. And we've never had an issue, but that basically the way that it would occur, definitely at the beginning, there will be more frequent board meetings.
board meetings, we always have a site administrator. So for example, this might answer your question. In those 14 schools, even though there's a global board meeting happening on one of the campuses, every school is open that day for the public board session. And they project and they have available what's happening at the meeting, so it's a public meeting and they can sign up to speak on the agenda. So there is always parent opportunity at their school to be part of the board meeting if it's not happening at their school. So every principal and local representative must be on campus the day of the board meeting if it's not happening at their site. Yeah. Here would be different. All the board meetings would be occurring here. And then the ones that might be zooming in would be any of the parent company board members that would have to kind of zoom in if there were votes and so forth to be able to be made.
Okay, so follow up question then. If you're saying that you're going to have a board, you are going to have live board meetings here where it would actually be taking place here. Mm-hmm. And then you plan on doing that monthly then? Or?
It depends. So like in the state of Florida, believe it or not, statute says mandatory is only 2 a year. We do board meetings based on, we put out a calendar every other month for a meeting. But it all these sometimes there's things that have to get business that has to be handled with the school, with the authorizers, or things that have to get signed, audits and so forth. And there might be some tentative meetings with board bylaws that are implemented. But typically we create an annual calendar that goes out into the websites and goes out to the parents and so forth every other month. Those are engraved kind of like in stone. If there's anything that requires in between, then they follow board policy and bylaws and so forth for announcing and making sure that they comply if they have to hold a board meeting off the schedule.
Okay, so is your camp council then going to be based out of Florida?
No, or? The council has already, Trip Scott has already made relations with council in Arizona, who's the one that's working on the what do you call it, on the when we did the
Marlin.
Yeah, because we had to, because of the time frame, we had to do the non
incorporate as a foreign entity.
As a foreign entity, but they're in the process of incorporating as a local entity once we're approved, and they do have the actual local representation. But council handles all legal and all that part for the board.
Any other follow-ups?
No, not yet.
Outside of Florida, and we're really impressed with the growth that Arizona has in its student population, and really the need. We then, did some further research with regards to the demographics, and like I mentioned, it's really the combination of the growth and the similarity in demographics that where we feel our model is going to be most effective. So that's the reason why we chose Arizona.
Who was it that approached you? What was the organization that approached you?
Actually, it was, and correct, I mean, this was a couple years back. I believe her name was Ashley. And then Ashley Bird. I thought that the model at that point would actually benefit some of those charter schools in Arizona.
Yeah, actually, that was the, we were at a national conference gathering. You know, there's a lot of networking when we go to these. I don't know if it was the one in Washington, D.C., or it was the one in
Tennessee.
It was a while back, and then through some mutual relay, we were networking, and someone said, you know, these guys, they've been doing great things, and they're not fearful into going into challenging communities, and they'll turn schools around, you know, after the first 2-3 years. And when we started talking, she's like, you know, Arizona's going through some challenges with its growth and the ability to be able to keep up with education, with the amount of population growth that we're having. At that point, we're like, oh, we were, you know,
we were still growing extensively in the state of Florida. We said, hey, we don't want to rush into it, but we stayed in touch. And we've been at this for about 2 years, I would say, coming and going, and meeting with different organizations and developers. And because, you know, real estate is a big part of it, being able to find a location that's suitable for what the need is. And throughout that, it kind of organically took its place. And now is when we felt we could, you know, it was the time to finally, you know, put it into place.
So specifically with the Buckeye area, I mean, there's so many other areas that have rapid growth going on in Arizona. Why specifically Buckeye?
I mean, you know, Buckeye was considered one of, I believe, the largest growing.
Actually, one of the third.
In the nation,
it's right? It's growing about 8% a year.
Yeah, and there's extensive diversity in population, you know, in that are actually within the area. And a lot of it has to do with when we looked at Goodyear.
We researched Odyssey schools in the area,
right.
Odyssey charter schools, and, you know, we know a developer schoolhouse, and we thought it was a good fit for us. Based on what we're doing in Florida, we thought that Buckeye would be a good fit based on the community.
Okay, so you're familiar with Odyssey then?
Yes. Part of our research was talking to, like, even the individuals from Academica, because they're also Florida based. So we kind of started, and I know they're fairly new coming in here, but we wanted to get feedback of operators and individuals that have actually not only operated charters, but, like, I know American Charter Developments was another group that was involved or has developed
an
ACD school. So we just, in part of our meetings and networking and so forth, it just felt that that's where we like to introduce ourselves to.
What is the most important contribution your proposed school will bring to the Buckeye community?
I think Ms. Katz, you could probably elaborate on that.
Absolutely. I think that based on our curriculum and the way our communication with the communities, the parents, and the way we handle our students within our school would be a great asset to Arizona, especially the fact that we master ourselves in providing professional development, finding new teachers that leave the universities and training them how to be mentors and having great, great teaching mentors at their hands. I think we do a great job recruiting teachers from all over. We also do a great job at maintaining their capacity, not only bringing in instructional needs to them and getting them supported throughout the year, but we also have the latest best practices. We have a team that is ongoing in providing one-on-one instructional development to all teachers. We also have what we call an ongoing monthly instructional team support facility where we bring all of our teachers from all over the state to come in and we provide them the latest research. We have ongoing data chats with our teachers. We're very big on professional development and we're very big on recruiting. And even if they're not master teachers, they're non-novice, we do our very best to teach them all the tools that they need to have so that they can be successful in the classroom. We also pride ourselves in our curriculum. I mean, it's top notch, I believe so. It's research based. We don't select any curriculum that has not been proven to be effective and meet all the students' needs. But moreover, I think what's gonna highlight the curriculum in Arizona is that we differentiate our instruction. And the way we do that is not like other places where they have differentiated instruction as need be. It's part of our instructional framework. We deal with a population that's extremely diverse. And therefore, we have to have a curriculum that meets each of the children within a holistic approach classroom. So what we do is within our instructional framework, we have a 2020 model, which depicts and deciphers tier 1, tier 2, and tier 3 students. And the instruction is planned during Common Planning. There is not one of our schools that does not have that. And during Common Planning, we unpack standards to ensure that the mastery of the standards are given and the students master those standards. And so we provide strategies within each group so that students are exposed. If it's ELL, visuals, we provide many visuals. We do not teach without visuals and without their translation of signaling out every item in the classroom. Whether we have one child that's ELL or 10 in the classroom, we make sure that we have the same strategies.
Okay.
because that one child is still part of the classroom. So I think that that's something that Arizona would be extremely grateful that we are part of them, because I hear that you do have a huge diverse community, and we've been doing our research on that, and that's what our curriculum is all about, is meeting the needs of the students throughout differentiated instruction. And then we have, I can say that we've been very successful utilizing iStation, Achieve 3000. We utilize technology throughout all of our curriculum, and the technology that we use, especially the LLI, and especially Achieve, I want to say, we not only enrich our students, but we also remediate, and we try to sustain those that are in the middle ground.
Can I ask a follow-up question? So you said that, you mentioned recruiting teachers, so it's not that easy to find a qualified.
It is right now very difficult, yes.
So how do you plan on going about recruiting teachers?
Very good question. I think that's a conversation that our entire team has been having. I have a very good connection with University of Central Florida. I worked for them for a very long time, and I am in great contact. I'm sure you all know about it, Reading More Church Center. It's the largest in the world. And he was my mentor for many years. And every time we need teachers, he helps me post all throughout, not just Orlando, Florida, which is where University of Central Florida is based, but he helps me post throughout the country and the world, because the Reading More Church from UCF is the world. It's not just the United States. So he helps me a lot with that. He has a partnership where he goes to one of our Tampa schools. He also provides professional development for us. And every time I'm in need of a teacher, it's just, you know, we try to recruit through him.
We have a large, like, between 7,000 employees. Our staff ratio globally, all staff, is about 1,000 employees throughout the state of Florida. And we have already done our due diligence for relocating and offering opportunities for individuals within the families that we do have and within the network that we do have that are interested. And in fact, we already have, if everything goes to place, we actually have an existing principal with family in Phoenix that's been with our model for some extensive time and was interested in relocating, which would allow her to stay with the organization that she doesn't want to leave. So I mean, we know the challenges and the shortages that, I mean, there were articles as recent as yesterday and the day before that come out constantly about teacher shortages and challenges in the education system here because of the diverse growth and the diverse population that you all serve. It is not an easy environment. In fact, most of the students, what we're experiencing, we become like a safe haven when many charters have bad reputations for only wanting to be opening in certain areas, only servicing certain communities. If you look at our portfolio, we will go into any community. That's why we have communities, charters that are 98% Black. We have charters that are 33, 33, 33, charters that are predominantly Anglo. We have them everywhere throughout the state of Florida because our model truly services any demographics. But most of what happens is that these children come working 2-3 grade levels below where they are, and it takes us 2-3 years, you know, to get them to that A and that B. But we're not fearful because we really truly believe in the model that we have. Part of what she was expressing is that the uniqueness and innovation to our model is that we extend our day by a short period of time in order to not make Spanish instruction an enrichment, but to have it run parallel with the language arts and reading that is happening in the classroom. So it kind of becomes a core subject within itself. And that's where we have had the success in our model, because they kind of, both those departments, Spanish and the language arts English teachers, plan together. So they're kind of running parallel through the differentiated instruction. They're kind of running parallel with the benchmarks and everything that's being covered. And that's where we've had the success in getting our children, you know, up to date, you know, and caught up within a couple of years to be actually able to perform proficiently.
Our extended secondary language double dose is the standard. So in other words, whatever standards we expose our students to in ELA, we're exposing them again in Spanish. So it's a double dose type of thing where they come out communicating and speaking in Spanish, but they also master the standard.
You also mentioned mentors and you're really big on teacher training. What does that actually look like?
So before she describes it, because it all comes from funding. So I'm the funding person. So if you notice in our budget, but this is how we've been able to grow the model, be able to provide that team, because that team is not site-based.
It's a global team that the board has been able to budget. So when I do their annual budgets and all their audits, there's a 1% fee that is charged for support for the breach prep brand and the fidelity, and that support is provided to that team, and that's the where that budget comes. So if you look at the budget, what she's about to explain to you comes and is already derived into the model of any breach prep we open anywhere. And I wanted to make sure you were aware that it's a team that's hired exclusively to support all the schools. They're not at a site level. This is a global floating travel team. And she'll tell you how they focus on our schools.
So we have an executive director, and then we have what we used to call them curriculum support specialists, but then I decided to change their role this school year to call them coordinators, right? Because I have instructional coaches in every school site. So I figured the curriculum support specialist would always end up double dosing with the coach, and it was just getting, I wasn't being as productive as I wanted it to be. So now they coordinate all, let me just start all over. The way it goes is we have a vision that comes from me down to my director, and we look at the data twice a month. From that data, we tier our teachers and our schools and our principals. It's a tiering process that I do a double arch, and I do the bell curve. Depending on what principal needs the most assistance, that will come, then I tier to assist and support that principal one-on-one myself, nobody else. My director tiers our APs, and she goes directly to support the APs that are in most need. And then our coordinators go to all schools, and each of my coordinators has an area of expertise. So an example, if there's a school that this month, because we don't assess students unless it's every 20 days to really get productivity. So if within 20 days when we look at our data, school A is our lowest, that's considered tier three, and that's where they will visit and monitor and support more often than a school that is tiered that month for a tier one. But we give ongoing daily support to all of our schools, our traveling team, based on the need. But regardless, even if they're a tier one and they're an A school, they're still gonna get support because we cannot forget about them. On the contrary, I have to try to push them, to enrich them, and to critically think as to how they can master to continue to sustain that A. So we're not only do that, we look at the data, we see what professional development is going to be best fit for that month, for that school. It's not always the same, and our professional development is not done on a global basis. We also look at professional development based on the data. We also have, just to complete how our process is, all of our principals must read all lesson plans. They give explicit corrective feedback on the lesson plans on a weekly basis. Lesson plans are turned in on Wednesday. By Friday, they're given complete explicit corrective feedback. I come in and my team, and we give it a little okay, and it goes back to the teachers to ensure that no teachers are teaching standards incorrectly. And that's the process and the cycle of our work. Our coaches then are providing professional development, and they work with the coaching cycle and coaching.
And that's at the instructional level, because in order to be able to properly manage remotely or have to be traveling, we also have Ms. Garcia, who's strictly responsible in being the mentor and the guide for our administrators at the school level. So from an operations standpoint, we have professional development, we have logistical training, the things that, because an educational leader, I would love to say a principal in a charter school is just gonna focus on education. That's not the reality of what a principal is walking into in a charter school. They are business leaders, they have to handle maintenance, they have to handle so many other things that go beyond instruction, and that department is managed and overseen by Ms. Garcia.
I have a follow-up. How will what your team provides be impacted by having Arizona location? You've got 14 schools.
Well, I think
in Florida.
I would love to answer that if I may, because even speaking about this with different individuals, and even with our principal that wants to come here, I think that at this moment, you guys are in need of teachers, not only to mention that certification is not mandated. We also allow teachers of all realms to come and teach in our schools here in Arizona. I'm saying ours, like if it's already ours, but I think they would benefit hugely, immensely, because we would be there if they're not educationally bound and they don't know the instructional practices, to be able to mentor them and be able to actually train them and sustain whatever training we provide to them to ensure that our students are getting top one quality instruction. And of course, we have to be realistic. They're not going to be if they're not from a teaching background, but we certainly, with my team, can provide all the best practices, all the instructional and systematic approaches to get them where they need to be in the continuum of teaching.
Yeah, Bridge Prep, what we've created in the last 10 years, and mind you, many of our schools have been around for a while, and that's what I think she says, even the ones that are already, they're running, and we have some schools that are still crawling, we still, you know, keep an eye on them, but in addition to that, they have their site administrator, their site coaches, their site infrastructure, so the depth of involvement always comes from the higher need, pre-opening schools that freshly have opened. But the area that her department really does is almost like a school district for a brand that's going to become a national brand. They oversee, and her department is exclusively travel. They're not planted in any one home base or area. Their job is to travel year round and be able to implement whatever the need is as the assessment has been determined for that specific campus. So it is basically like having district support, you know, coming through your campuses on a rotation.
And not like what you know of district support. I love district because I worked on it, but we really work hand in hand, and we leave a coach in place in house so that we ensure that coach knows how to roll over and turnkey all of our practices.
Yeah,
we also create mentors.
It's not a model that becomes codependent. On the contrary, what we're trying to do is get them to the standard so then the coordinators can just kind of, you know, manage and supervise. But, you know, at the beginning, yeah, there's a lot of training, a lot of professional development until we build that capacity where they're able to sustain it. It's about a 2-3 year plan before they're able to kind of, you know,
release.
And I travel a lot. I support new schools mainly. Mm-hmm. I support all the schools. But if we were to open here, I anticipate I'd be here 3 weeks at least at the beginning, or a month, or whenever necessary. That's what I do. I come in. I would be very fortunate if the principal we're thinking about does want to come relocate here, because she has experience and knows our systems. But we have opened in different counties. We have people that come from a county, from out of town. And my role is to work alongside with them, to try to recruit students, to try to get the community to know us, to go to the county fair, whatever it takes. We have had meetings in movie theaters to try to get our programs out there with the assistance of this team. But I'm the one staying behind, making sure every step of the way that we meet all the requirements. We open school on time, we receive the furniture, we have a parent group that we meet with. So everything, every step that needs to be taken in a school, I take great pride and responsibility for that school. We just don't open, give you the keys, and go away. We stay for a while, and then we come back as the principal requests, as the district says, oh, this is not happening, or the state, we will come back. We opened, our last school that we opened was in Collier County in Naples, Florida. And I do, it's a small school, but I do go there frequently because that principal did not have experience. So anything that she needs support with, I work alongside with her.
So what you're saying then is that the school is in Arizona, you're based out of Florida.
Yes.
That when you tier the school and then you have the principal, you have the assistant principal, you will be sending out people physically, whether
Absolutely.
It's 1, 2, 3 people, to on a rotational basis
Correct.
To come out to Arizona to make sure that they are.
To be honest, it'll be from my team. It'll be on a weekly basis, especially at the
start. Inception.
Yeah. Inception. Mm-hmm.
But yes, the support that they're describing is live. Mm-hmm. It's all budgeted with travel expenditures from the nonprofit. It's all, you know, part of that 1% that I was expressing to you, that it's all live support, in addition to having, you know, remote support or even having Zoom meetings and so, because sometimes it's just a matter of they want
they know the answer, they just want reassurance, things like that. But at the beginning, until they're very familiar with the expectations and the standards that the board has been establishing and our processes, and the processes, there's extensive on-site.
Okay. So you don't have any intentions of like having, okay.
Okay, I know where you're going.
No,
on-site, at the local level, having it, and that would come with the, with, and we have talked about that, you know, so is that where you were going to?
No, that's right. No, I was, it was something else, so that's okay. I'm good. Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
You're up. All right. Still thinking about that. All right. Okay. So, what if the Arizona location needs to make a policy change? Describe how would that, what would that process look like? Being from outside out of state.
No, I read policy. You know, that's the board's main role is the policymakers. So, at the end of the day, if there's anything that needs to instill change in policy, the first thing that goes, it goes to council, and council has to make sure that. It's checking the standards and the statutes that relate to the Arizona requirements, and then those all have to be done at the board level, and that's where I said that we have board meetings, and then there's always other board meetings that might need to come up, because sometimes there's policy changes even within the state of Florida by districts, and those things have to be revisited on a consistent basis. We have to come up with different issues that different boards. From different schools, because in Florida, we're not managed by a state authorizer. We're managed by the school district. We're sponsored, by the school district. So that is the working relationship. It's a little bit different than how you have it here. So even though we're in the state of Florida in 10 different counties, we have 10 different ways that things get done, even from the submission of our financial statements. It's a state requirement, but every district wants it done differently. So we're constantly revisiting policy and constantly working with, we have great working relationships with the school districts that sponsor us.
It's kind of like we're in 10 different states right now.
Yes, it is. In Florida, that's how it works. Every county is a different state. They operate completely different, use different systems. Everything is completely different.
Can I ask a follow-up? How do those different, so they're not authorizers as much as sponsors?
They are. This that we hold here is held at the district level.
Right.
It's like going.
So do they do site visits?
Yes. But it's ironic because we're also their competition. So we've always said it's like Uber going to the taxi cab organization to get for a school, or McDonald's asking Burger King. And a lot of those districts we have that tension. But after a while working with us, they're like, okay, these aren't business people. Every single person here, except him, but through his wife, was in a classroom at one point. Mm-hmm. And I like to make that statement because even though we're business and so forth, we all were educators. At one point, every single person from the managing firm, that's something we take pride in. So when they really see that we're truly educators, it's not a business venture, it's not a real estate acquisition, it's not, they're like, okay, hold on. And when they see that we go into some of the neighborhoods and open schools and have success, they're like, well, hold on, not many want to risk, you know, investments and so forth, knowing that the population is very low performing. And our portfolio speaks for itself, but it is challenging. Every school that we go apply to, if you want to go to Broward County, you meet with the Broward County School Board. If you want to go to Miami-Dade County, this process happens with the Miami-Dade County School Board. It's every county. So we deal with 10 different sponsors right now.
Okay, so this is about curriculum. What is the process for a curriculum update, and what part do local parents and community partners play?
Excellent questions. We run a parent as partners on a monthly basis. It's our parents as partners is called. And we conduct surveys every 9 weeks to see how parents feel about the curriculum. If they would, you know, do they see their children progressing or lack thereof? And we read those surveys, and we also send them out to teachers. Not always the same teachers. We do it like sporadically and see what we get back, just so that they don't feel, I'm gonna write my name, and then they're gonna. We do it like anonymous, and my team reads it. And so, like, I'll be very honest, there's been one program that has been giving us, teachers have, and she's probably gonna laugh, the surveys have been indicating that it's a difficult program. Amazing ratings throughout the state for it, but teachers are having a difficult time implementing it and teaching it. And so we take that into accountability and we make adaptations, because if the, you know, we wait 3 years at least to see if there was productivity or not. and then we go back to the drawing board and we make the adaptations by need of what we hear from not only the teachers, the principals, but also the parents, which are our number one concern.
And the parents, the main thing is educating them to what's required. So in Florida, you have to have, you know, Florida standards research. I mean, you just can't say, well, we're going to switch and just go and do this. There's requirements.
Yeah, we got to give it.
Yeah, so the parents have to be educated on the statutes and the requirements of being part of public education. It's not, well, in this private school, they might be able to use it, but we have standards when you get government funding education, and we have to abide by those. Because all our charter applications, we can always, in Florida, they allow you to put in your own curriculum, but we like to run as proud as possible to the state standards, you know, because kids, you know, there's a lot of mobility. Kids come into charters, go back into public schools, and we don't want to disenfranchise them to a certain point where they're struggling, so we try to kind of run as possible.
And as our location states, we try to stay within the boundaries of every state, every district that we go to within their comprehensive reading plan. And we don't like to provide a curriculum or for any core area that's not research-based. So we try to always, our team would never select curriculum that's not research-based and has been proven effective.
Hi, guys. Okay. So just a quick question. So you have a curriculum for science, LLA science. I don't see one for social ed per se, these storylines.
That's what we saw from your district. We always look at the comprehensive reading plan for social studies because what we use is not accounted for all different areas, but for social studies, we use Houghton Mifflin, we use Time Magazine, we use Achieve 3000, which is also in the curriculum. Achieve 3000 was first created for social studies, so we utilize it for social studies.
I guess my question is the curriculum update. So with the new standards for science and social studies, how would you account for any change in curriculum?
We already made the changes. Elevate was the last one that came out for almost, I want to say 42 states, that it was approved as the new science that came out. And for social studies, that's why we're using Time Magazine with the new law for the women's regression. That's part of it too. And the law was correct. We utilize novels also in our social studies.
So you have the school districts, this is the various school districts that are your oversight, right?
Correct.
That you have to account for. So when you decide to make curriculum changes, I'm just trying to figure out what you have to do, what you have to follow, what you have to do with them in order to...
It's a huge process. We just had one in her school.
Okay.
The district comes out and we have to discuss why we want to make the change. We have to, you know, show proof of how many parents, you know, did not feel that it was successful or not. And we also have to discuss how the school, we have to prove with the data. The Miami Dade, they didn't accept just us saying it or surveys. They don't care. They want data. So we actually proved with the data that there hasn't been progress.
And it's contractual. There's language in the contract that basically guides you when you have to, you know, when you want to differentiate, or just because you need to have that autonomy,
flexibility.
But they are going to make sure that if you are going to make the changes in the best interest, so the sponsor really hold you accountable to justify why. It just doesn't happen because you say so.
And just to add, they'll allow us to use it supplemental during our DI. But then they want the core to be the one they recommend. And we have no problem with doing it. Sometimes we'll want to hear their side of why, and then we'll go to them.
So, because you've kind of already answered our question number 7 about professional development, I'd love to hear from Mr. Garcia, Mr. Rivero, so we haven't heard as much from you guys. And you were facilities?
No, facilities.
You're facilities. Mm-hmm. What's your role going to be around that with an Arizona school?
Basically, at this point, what we've done is we've researched Verado, researched a few communities and outskirts of the areas. We partnered up with ACD and Capital R, which have done several schools in Arizona. We've also spoken to Schoolhouse, who's built Odyssey and several other schools. So my role is to come in as soon as, if we were to get approved, there's a permitting process that takes 3 months. So it's a tight timeline. So it's almost like a lot of the legwork is being done as we speak, whether it goes through or not. We're, like we always do. So what we do is, we would figure that by March, permits are in place, shovel in the ground, and it gives us a good 5 months to have a building in place. At that point, myself is here. I have other people that facilitate the experience from Miami flying with me down here. Aside from the contractor and developer that have already had the experience in tight timeline, not in Florida, but in Arizona, knowing exactly how the process works, not only with architects, engineers, land developers, economic development. We met with the economic development director?
Yeah.
At Buckeye. To just get an idea of what his field was in the area. And he, as he stated in the letter, I believe, he proposed that he was good for it. He said, I think the area needs it. I think it'll be a good mold for the area. So I'm on it all the way through the first day of school. So once we get approved or whatever the case may be, we're here for the next 5 or 6 months, aside from whoever's on site already, the contractor and the developer themselves.
Is there a plan B if shoveling the ground, permitting, all those
plans? We always have what's called a modular system.
Okay.
And we get those in 3 months, which is a modular system, a temporary system, mm-hmm. until
the first phase is completed.
Right, mm-hmm. until the first phase is completed.
And depending on the feedback.
Because what we don't like to do is have kids disenfranchise them and put them somewhere else and then bring them back to the school. So we try to do it at the site. Mm-hmm. So we'll set up modulars for the time being, and then when we're ready to go, we're ready to go. That's plan B.
Have you ever run across that in opening schools in Florida where yeah. you had to go to plan B? Or
we just opened a 72,000 square foot building within a month's time of school opening. I mean, most of our schools are new construction, and we were very experienced in that area, being able to guide the board in those relationships with turnkey, you know, agreements so that they are affordable, and they have escalation agreements. But we have yet to any of the, and we have 14 charters, but many more locations because some of them have multiple campuses within
X amount of radius.
Two block mm-hmm. radius.
Right, so they call it, it's really
it might be one charter, but the middle school.
But operates
exactly.
Exactly.
There's 20 different campuses. One of the things that we've specialized in is being able to have our timelines, you know, and even though.
And we've met with home developers. I've met with home developers. We've seen how many permits are getting pulled in certain areas.
We did our research.
We have home developers that are willing to assist. We run into problems. So
consultants, they're right. part of the budget for consulting and so forth. But we have an experience where we have had to tell a group of parents we're not going to be ready. Mm. It hasn't happened once.
Yes.
When we do formative assessments, we do it to get as much information as we possibly can for the students in order to plan for instruction that's going to be right there on the moment and ongoing. And summative is what we consider constantly that it's ongoing, and it gives us a global, more of a global versus more of a direct approach.
Okay.
So we get information from both, obviously. Okay, but when we talk about formative, is we're getting, that's our formal assessment, but we're getting assessment to inform us as the teacher and inform the student of their instruction. Right, how to drive their instruction, or for the teacher to drive the instruction and for the student to know where he or her is at. And summative for us is like when we include the in-house assessment, when we include the state assessment, when we include everything and just wrap up all the needs of the students in a global aspect.
Okay. Can I ask about a particular subject?
Yeah.
So for example, in instructional analysis, sixth grade, I was just reading through and your reading lesson deals with determining author's point of view. But one of the summative assessment options is collaborative discussion. So how is collaborative discussion going to be assessed as a summative assessment to see if they've actually garnered the...
We always utilize rubrics, and our rubrics are part of also our summative assessment and formative assessment, depending how we create during our common planning that rubric and how it's going to be utilized. So as we're having either collaborative discussion, we also have, during collaborative discussion, we have Socratic circles, literature circles. We consider that collaborative discussions as well. And there's rubrics that we have created for all those activities. We have literature circles in our school being conducted, I want to say, on a bi-weekly basis, and Socratic seminars for all of our social studies and ELA classes, where we use rubrics as our summative assessment.
I guess, and then one more about formative assessment that I was curious about. So you wrote, someone wrote partner reading for formative assessment for point of view. So can you just describe what does partner reading look like and how do you get formative assessment from just reading?
Good question. When we talk about partner reading, as we're all educators here, we know it could either be the triad reading, or it could be the buddy reading, or the think, pair, share, write reading. So if I'm doing a think, pair, share, write reading, whether I'm doing buddy or triad reading, we're going, after we finish the reading, we're gonna do what? Think, pair, share, and then we're gonna write. So our discussion will be during the share, and then our assessment will be during the write. So we utilize think, pair, share, write during any buddy reading, choral reading, echo reading. For example, if you have a fluency issue and you're my student, the discussion is going to be on, your strategy is gonna be echo reading. Why? Because repeated reading is gonna get you fluent. So I'm not gonna be able to give you a formative assessment on that. So when you write on the part of the strategy section, then I can give you the assessment. That will be your assessment. We utilize think, pair, share, write for almost all of our reading to ensure that our teachers are not just having students read. Like, we eliminated popcorn reading, we eliminated jump-in reading, because research states there's nothing that we're going to gain from that. But we also have to assess our students and whether or not they're being fluent and they're also comprehending. One thing is being fluent, another thing is being fluent and being able to comprehend.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
I do.
Oh, I do too.
Okay, so.
How long did it take between opening your first school in Florida? Did you decide to replicate that, or was it you went in with the replication?
No, so in Florida, so our history, and this is our 10-year anniversary. So our history, we opened our first charter in the South Florida, Miami-Dade area. Before we considered going into other counties, I believe we had four in Miami-Dade. It took us a few years, you know, where we created we wanted to have diversity, because even you're in one county, every community and municipality is different. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to make sure our model was something that was diverse enough that would be able to get taken out just of the South Florida area, where it's a predominant Hispanic community. And then after a few years, and we saw our successes, that if we started our first year with children from 30 different schools because of the overcrowding, or brand new to the county, and all migrant, we knew they were so far behind them with the state standard grading system, they was gonna be a low school, but after 3 years, they were a B or an A. We knew that we had something. So then after like year three, we went ahead and branched into Broward, got a couple schools there. Then, so we started going up north, and then around year six and seven, is when we, the systems and the mechanisms and the infrastructure support and everything was already in place, that we were able to start going, you know, into further up north, bigger developments, and because we were able to, the capacity was there. So it was kind of like an organic growth. It didn't, you know, it wasn't an irresponsible, I want it all. It happened gradually. Mm-hmm. It took us 10 years to get out of Florida, to put it that way, which is where we're ready now, even though we were approached 3 years ago.
Okay, so mine is about the diversity of Florida versus the diversity of Arizona. I was wondering if you could tell us what the similarities, give us an idea or a picture in our mind of what is the diverse student population in Florida, and how is that similar or different to the diverse population that we have here?
Yeah, so with us, the Hispanic diversity, that we get throughout the state of Florida are either Caribbean or especially now with the hurricanes and things like that have impacted the Bahamas, that have impacted Puerto Rico, where there was a huge influx of Puerto Rican families that not only came as children but as teachers, they were completely disenfranchised from their community, and the state has done a lot of honoring of Puerto Rican class and teaching certificates and so forth. But we have also areas that are predominantly Anglo in Tampa, where we have maybe 60%, and I believe that's very similar to the growth there, because there's a substantial Anglo growth there from California and so forth that's also been coming into Arizona. So what we learned is that the model that we have really did not have a negative impact based on the native language. In fact, where everybody assumed that our model was geared towards Black and Hispanic ELL students only, it was highly sought out in other areas in the state of Florida that were not predominantly Spanish-speaking communities, because these families wanted their children to have a second language, and because our model is not just an enrichment, it's truly aligned side by side with the language arts, ELL, ELA, it really was it's a high demand model for any culture, any background. What we do know is that the child that still thinks in their native language, if it's not English, you know, it does take them a while, you know, to be able to meet the way the system is grading us, which is our language, our English content. But it's a faster, the gap gets closed faster because of our Spanish model running parallel to our ELA model. So we've had gains and differences in on both sides of the coin. That's why we say we service native and non-native. And most, when you hear, we're not bilingual, because bilingual technically you have to be from the beginning. Right? So then how do you feed kids in that wanted to come to your program in third grade? So we have systems and diversity in place to differentiate instruction that no matter what grade level you come into, they have to take a Spanish program. It's not an option. That's number one. But we have mechanisms in place to be able to then have differentiated instructions to bring those children up. But we have felt that the diversity in demographics, it hasn't really been a determining factor in success. It's just, it might take a little longer when you're predominantly a Hispanic community.
What about Native American students?
Native Americans, we actually have, especially in the South Florida area, we have extensive Seminole tribes, we have extensive Miccosukee tribes. We're surrounded by a lot of them. Most would think they want to get educated in their reserves or in their own schools. But at the end of the day, it's being able to adapt to the cultural involvement that they would have to, the parents would have to buy into the role. But if they're making a choice to place their children in a charter school with a Native American academic background, doesn't get impacted in any means whatsoever by the way that we're instructed, because we have so much diversity already within our model. It's more the parental and community involvement that we definitely have to invest in, you know, to make sure that they bought in and are vested into the school.
Mm-hmm. How do you get that parental and community involvement, say with the Native Americans or non-English speakers, Puerto Ricans?
What we've learned, and you probably be able to elaborate more, but what we've learned is that we have systems in place that have the parents and the community feel that this is their school. They're not delegated to
They're not necessarily being told. That's why that parent representative team that meets with the school administration on a consistent basis as a voice for the parents becomes useful. We're very big in activities. We're very rigid. If you go to our website, there's a community activity happening on campus, out of school hours, constantly, because what we're trying to do is say this is your school. It's in your best interest and in our best interest that we take this right together. It's not us saying you're coming to us, now go. On the contrary, we're actually constantly trying to make sure that we seek a common ground of all the diverse. You're gonna have Native American, you're gonna have Korean, you're gonna have Anglican, but yet we're all living together and educating your children in one location. The only way that really can be done is by kind of merging them consistently through activities and community engagement. And we've had great success with it. Our parental involvement is extensive in all our campuses, no matter where it's at.
If you look at any of our school's websites, this month we'll have a harvest activity,
trunk or treat.
My main school, and my largest school in Miami, will have trunk or treat tomorrow night. And during Thanksgiving, and these could be viewed as fundraisers, but not necessarily. During Thanksgiving, we have a culture where we invite all the parents during the school day, and we have a Thanksgiving feast, and we encourage that because that's a great time to take pictures, get to know the families. It's during the day. For me, if the main school of Miami, Halloween, we have. Not everybody celebrates Halloween, so we have spooky grandparents reading day. So grandparents come dressed as characters, and we have great fun. And it's all educational during the day, but we try to bring in the grandparents, the parents, the surrogate parents. We have all kinds of kids in Miami, kids who drive a Rolls Royce to school, and we have kids who live in a shelter. So we provide for that in everything that we do. You can't afford it, it's not a problem, but we love to bring our families in, and I think that's what makes us very special in each one of our campuses.
There's extensive cultural sensibility, you know, sensitively, because there are communities that, and even though we have a what is called a public persona standard, where we really can't, even when it comes to religion and so forth, we always do, you know, ask the site level administrators to make sure they know the demographics of who they're serving, what they're serving, and that there's cultural sensitivity. To not insult in any way, but not also restrict anything from engaging in any activity and so forth, as long as it's done correctly and through communication and with cultural sensitivity. For example, the holiday events that when we have, usually those holiday shows, they're gonna have Kwanzaa, they're gonna have Hanukkah, it's gonna be a little bit of everything and every kind of representation to not show that there's gonna be an exclusive, you know, kindergarten class only doing, you know, Santa, for example. So there has to be sensitivity. Mm-hmm. And we've been blessed, it's been a role, but we have extensive cultural diversity in our school.
Thank you. Right, thank you. To conclude the in-person interview, I will describe what will be happening next. The technical review panel will evaluate the scores from the review of the written application package, as well as the findings of the interview panel. This will include whether your written application package met the screening criteria specified in the application, and whether the interview panel finds sufficient capacity to operate the charter school. Next, a recommendation report will be submitted to board staff and will be presented to the board at the December 9th, 2019 meeting. This will be a full day meeting that will begin at 9 a.m. We anticipate that this will be a long meeting, so please plan for the possibility of your application being considered on December 10th, 2019, if the meeting runs long. If you have any questions about next steps, please contact Rachel Hanna, the Board Assistant Director of Charter Schools Support and Accountability. You have a copy of her card. Once again, the Arizona State Board of Charter Schools, the technical review panel, and board staff would like to thank you for coming in today and for your interest in providing quality educational choice to the children of the state of Arizona. Safe travels.
Thank you.
I have a question. The December 9th and 10th, are we expected to be present?
Oh. I would highly recommend it.
Yeah.
It would have to be.
That is the board's final. The consideration process has three components. One, your application package itself. Two, the results of this capacity interview as indicated in the recommendation report. And the third thing the board can consider is anything said before them the day of the board meeting.
Right.
And it would be rare for an applicant not to be at that board meeting mm-hmm. to represent.
Yeah, it's kind of like, imagine this being the CRC. That
right.
we used to, and then it goes to board for vote.
Just
so,
make
yeah.
sure
yeah.
Yeah, so we can make our travel arrangements.
Great question. Yeah, yeah. Highly important.
Just from a budget perspective, because there's so many supplemental budgets, and I don't know if this needs to be, but I know that you guys have the startup grants here because that's a federal grant, which we're very experienced with and have had great success. Title I, I'm assuming there's a supplemental revenue on that. Is there a cap in the state of Florida? There's a capital outlay
mm-hmm.
for school because we're a district accredited firm by SACS accredited by Advanced Ed. So that allows the charter when they're managed by a district accredited managing firm to receive supplemental revenue for capital outlay. Is that something Arizona does with charters or is
not
it
that I'm aware of? And I think the difference being you guys are in more of a district based model or we're not. That being said, the person to ask that question is over there in that office because the association is more, we don't touch funding for charters really, other than if something goes wrong and we have to pull funds.
Right.
That all goes to ADE, but the Charter Association probably speak very clearly
that
to
it's
that.
Just
so
just because the budget was so raw,
yeah.
really, we had to do the budget raw, but I know that there's so many, when you've been around and you're accredited, there's other supplemental, you know, to that kind of incentivize, you know, having organizations that are established and successful. So that's where I wanted to.
Yeah.
Even in Florida, usually it's not included when we submit applications. And
yeah,
one of the questions we always get back is, why did you guys include these funds when it's supposed to be 3 years?
Yeah, there's only three firms in the whole state that have the accreditation that we have, which allows government subsidized capital outlay immediately upon opening.
I don't know that exists in Arizona,
mm-hmm.
but we can check with them.
That'd be fantastic.
Yep.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.